This morning I'll continue teaching from this wonderful text, The Way of the Bodhisattva, by the 8th century great Indian Buddhist practitioner, Shantideva. And for those of you who are new in our community, part of our practice is we do these practice periods called intensives for 3 and 6 months. And we do them continually throughout the year in order to give our members opportunities to practice more deeply various teachings and practices of our Buddhist tradition. Right now we have 2 intensives going on. One intensive, which involves probably about 50 people, is on the practices and teachings of loving kindness and compassion. And we have about 70 people studying the teachings and the practices found in this text, The Way of the Bodhisattva. I mean, there's a lot to be said here, and a lot has been said. So for those of you who knew, I would say there are talks on our website and lots of good things available. This is a very famous and well-known, well-commented-on Buddhist text by Shantideva. But what I'm going to work on today is just a piece of chapter 4. In the first 3 chapters, we know Shantideva has set forth this idea of enlightenment, the enlightened mind, this bodhi in Sanskrit, this bodhicitta, this awakened mind, and that this awakened mind, awakening to this awakened mind, which is really the fundamental mind of all beings, is the very source of all the wisdom and compassion and understanding and marvelous activities of all the enlightened beings in our tradition for 2,600 years, going back to the Buddha. It is not just studying. It is realization of this enlightened mind. But he also sets forth that the reason we want to awaken to this mind is not simply to free ourselves from our suffering or to benefit ourselves, but is because we understand that all beings in this world suffer, and we want to benefit them, we want to help them, we want to free them from their sufferings. But to do that, we have to know what we're doing, and so we have to embark on this path of study and most importantly, practice, this training, so we have the abilities to really have the wisdom and the compassion that we can truly benefit beings. So having set forth in the first 3 chapters, I just summarized very quickly, chapter 4 is called carefulness. It's like, okay, you know, this is what we want to do. You know, we want to cultivate all this wholesomeness in life, but we have to be careful. We have to be very conscientious. It doesn't just come by itself. Again, I'm just picking parts of the chapter today to focus on. I think it's very interesting. He says, this is now in 27, and for those who aren't familiar, this is poetry. So this is not only a great text of all the wisdom of the Buddhist tradition in about 9 or 10 chapters, but he also did it in verse, so it's a wonderful, just as a spiritual, religious text, it's really one of the great ones. So he says, I am as if benumbed by sorcery, as if reduced to total mindlessness. I do not know what dulls my wits, or what it is that has me in my grip, in its grip. I'm as if benumbed by sorcery, as if reduced to total mindlessness. I do not know what dulls my wits or what is that has me in its grip. So, again, it's like many of us. We have wonderful intentions, wonderful aspirations in our life of how we want to be, just as a person, in relationships, in the world, with others, with ourselves. And yet we often find, you know, that's not the way we show up in life, right? So he says, you know, it's as if I'm benumbed like by sorcery. You know what I mean? Like it's like somebody's taken over my mind or something because, you know, this is, I want this. I know this is right. And yet it's like I have something else has me in its grip. Okay? Does everybody, Can we relate to that a little bit, to one degree or another? So he says, you know, what is it? And then he goes, anger, lust, these enemies of mine, are limbless and devoid of faculties. They have no bravery, no cleverness. How then have they reduced me to such slavery? They dwell within my mind, and at their pleasure injure me. All this I suffer meekly, unresenting. Thus my abject patience, all displaced. So this is really, you know, again, so he says, so in that first verse, he says, you know, what's going on here? You know, I have such good intentions, aspirations in my life. I want to be a good person. But like, you know, what's beclouded me that I can't see straight and don't act that way so often? And he says, anger, lust, these enemies of mine. So this, when he says anger, lust, this is like a whole list, right, in Buddhist psychology of these emotional afflictions. So he calls them anger, lust. I thought that was interesting, you know. Because if you go back to traditional Buddhist texts, I mean, the major afflictions are not only anger, but they're lust, desire, and greed. And I thought, I wonder how many people would see these as their major afflictions today. I mean, actually, not having enough lust is a problem in our society. You know, how things have changed, right? I mean, the idea that somehow this unbridled sexual passion and energy always looking for an outlet is somehow very disturbing to the mind and very disturbing to behavior, as it was traditionally thought, these days it's the opposite, isn't it? I mean, we live in a society that's constantly feeding sexuality, right? And again, and if you're not like, you know, at the top of your game, there's something wrong with you. So I thought this was very interesting, how times have changed, you know, and like greed. I mean, if you go to the traditional test, it's like, you know, greed. Well, we know that we live in a society where like greed is good, right? You know, you should always want more. Right? I mean, that should be like the prime motivation of life, greed. So it's very, and just reading this, I'm thinking, how times have changed, you see. And yet I think there's something meaningful here. Because when we talk about afflictive emotions, we're talking about emotions that disturb the tranquility and peace of the mind. Emotions, afflictive emotions, are things that are emotional states that afflict my aspiration for how I want to be in this life, how I want to show up in this life. Emotional afflictions are things that disturb relationship and the social good. Is that clear? So it's just very interesting how today, the way we view what emotional affliction is really kind of off base very much. And that we actually, as a society or sectors of society, can, you know, cultivate emotional afflictions like greed and lust and anger as if they're good things and produce personal and social good. So we have to be clear again. So he says, so he calls these emotional afflictions, he said, you're my enemies. Because, again, for all the reasons I just said. And then he goes, but what's going on here? He says, you know, it's not as if these emotional afflictions are like physical entities, right? You know, that can really, you know, that have a mind of their own. They're brave, they're courageous, they're really intelligent, they're sneaky. He said, you know, they're not like that at all. Why am I their slave? And then in the next verse he says, they dwell within my mind and at their pleasure injure me. Right? So it's again, I think I want to share with you that this is a very interesting way to view our kind of dysfunctional emotions, our fears and our angers and our greeds and our hurts and our jealousies and our envies and our despairs and our sadness. You know, we don't see them as emotional states that are doing me harm. Right? They are doing me harm. We see them as just emotional states and we think everybody else has them. And they're kind of normal. But he says, no, these are, they dwell within my mind and they do harm to me. And at their pleasure, they injure me. At their pleasure means what? Wherever, whenever. Right? Wherever, whenever, I can get angry, I can get pissed, I can get irritated, I can get frustrated, I can get hurt, I can get sad, I can get worried, I can get scared, I can get, you know, right? Anywhere. Home. On the internet. Reading. Out in the community. Just hearing about something. You know, I can take it everywhere. They will come up. And then he said, and all this I suffer meekly, unresenting, thus my abject patience all displaced. You know, he says, wow. You know, what a thing to be patient with. These emotional afflictions that cause me and others suffering, I'm so long suffering with these. You know, decade after decade after decade. I just continue to accept that they're in my mind and they're present to me, and anytime they arise, you know, I indulge them. At their pleasure, they injure me. Not at my pleasure, at their pleasure. And where do they all dwell? He says, within my mind. Oh, my enemy, afflictive passion, endless and beginningless companion, no other enemy indeed is able to endure so long. You have been my companion since endless time. You know, he says, I really can't think of any other enemy that I have that has been with me so long. You know, so again, I just very much enjoy the way he, very different than we do, the way he looks at afflictive emotion, dysfunctional emotional states. He says, all other foes that I appease and wait upon will show me favors, give me every aid. But should I serve my dark, defiled emotions, they will only harm me and draw me down with grief. He says, you know, if I had other enemies and foes, right, and if I was always appeasing on them and being very supportive of them, and he said, you know, they in turn would probably treat me kindly. You know? He said, but here I am serving all these dark emotional states within myself, and they only harm me. Right? He said, they're not even a good enemy. Because if I surrendered to my enemy and gave them their way, they'd probably treat me well, you know. He says, but these internal foes, my afflictive emotions, you know, it doesn't matter how much I indulge them. They continue unrelentingly to harm my well-being, my mind, my peace of mind, my desire for wholesome emotional states. Continually they rob me. If thus my ancient and unceasing foes, the wellspring only of my growing pain, can lodge so safe within my heart, how can I live so blithe and fearless in this wheel of life? So if it's true that within my own mind dwell these ancient foes of mine, foes meaning what? Again, that they harm me. They do harm to me. They do harm to others as they act through me. They are the wellspring of my pain in life, my emotional suffering. And they lodge within my own heart mind. Right? And yet, he says, I go through my life so blithely as if these things aren't really dwelling within, as if everything's okay. You know, people say, how's everything going? Everything's going fine. I'm just taking good care of my anger and my fear, you know. All is well. They're all very healthy. You know, they're good and healthy and strong. I'm, you know, cultivating them quite finely. Thank you very much. I mean, he kind of says, "What? This is crazy, isn't it? That we do not recognize these foes, these enemies that dwell within us." Right? We would never, if there was really somebody who really just, you know, we were so scared of, or we were so angry at, or so hateful at, we would never just invite them to live with us, would we? Right? And always make sure they're happy so they stay around forever, right? You know, sometimes we have people who come to stay with us, guests, and, you know, sometimes we're quite happy that it's a short visit. Right? But yet these afflictive emotions, we let them stay forever and act as if everything is all right. Now I'm skipping ahead a little bit. He said, when fishers, butchers, farmers, and the like, intending just to gain their livelihood, will suffer all the miseries of heat and cold, why, for beings' happiness, should those like me not bear the same? So now we're moving in a little different direction. He's returning to this this aspiration of a bodhisattva, right? Who has said that he aspires to bring happiness to all beings. And yet he says, I am so kind of indolent. I am so uncareful. I am so unvigilant. I am so undiligent in the way I am not caring for my internal mind states. Right? I'm just so unwilling to do the work. And he says, you know, look at ordinary people, right? In those days, ordinary people, you know, were fishers, butchers, farmers, and the like. He said, you know, look what a hard life they have, right? Look how much they put up with heat and cold and hard work and all kinds of difficulties. And they're just earning a living. They're just trying to survive. And they'll put up with all these difficulties. And yet, in my pursuit of my spiritual path, of my transformative path, of my desire to be happy and free, you know, I'm so lazy. You see what he's saying? I'm so, ooh, that's a little hard work, you know. I mean, there could be many people here in just the pursuit of their career, in just the pursuit of earning a living, right, have put up with a lot. Is that true? Have gone through a lot of difficulty just to earn a living, right? Just to complete a degree, just to, I mean, I could go on and on, you know. We have been willing to put up with so much hardship, right? And yet, when it comes to our spirit, you know, oh, meditation, too hard. Discomfort in my legs. Ooh, too hard. It's too difficult. Right? Can you see? And yet, in other areas of our life, we'll put up with all kinds of difficulties, all kinds of discomforts, right? For just worldly aims that have just, you know, very immediate results, but they really don't produce anything lasting. So I think he's really... I think he's calling us out, so to speak. But he's talking about himself. He says, when I pledge myself to free from their afflictions, beings who abide in every region, stretching to the limits of the sky, I myself was not free from such defilements. So he's returning to these earlier chapters when he says, yes, you know, I want to free all beings from their afflictions, from their ignorance, to really help all beings know the path that creates happiness and well-being. That's what I want to do. And yet, I myself had many of the same afflictions that I vow to free others from, and how unwilling I am often to do the work that is necessary. How unwilling I am to do the work that will produce the results that I can actually be someone, having freed myself from my own emotional afflictions, from my own egocentricity, from my own narrowness of heart. I now have something that I've experienced myself and know myself that I can really share with others. Is that clear? He's pointing to himself at his own kind of hypocrisy. You see what I'm saying? His own hypocrisy. Again, noticing how indulgent he is of his own emotional afflictions, how well he takes care of these enemies within. Common foes, when driven from the state, retreat and base themselves in other lands, and muster all their strength to return. But enemy afflictions are without such stratagems. We're saying, you know, your ordinary enemy, right? When you finally drive them away, you know, completely out of your country, he said, well, they may go to another country and kind of regroup, right? To kind of come back, you know, and attack us. And he says, but these afflictions, these emotional afflictions, these enemies, they don't have that kind of intelligence. Once they're vanquished, they're vanquished. Once they're really gone, they're gone. So he says, miserable defilements scattered by the eye of wisdom, where will you now run when driven from my mind? Whence would you return to do me harm? Oh, my mind is so feeble, I am so indolent. So now it's going to take a little different direction, because he basically really sets forth his, beside, you know, this strong carefulness and this recognition, the capacity to label all our emotional afflictions as enemies. Many of us don't do that, do we? We say, yeah, I'm really stressed today. Or I'm really anxious today. I'm really worried, or I'm really sad, or I'm really jealous, or I'm really irritated, or I'm really frustrated, or I'm really down. You know what I'm saying? We talk about these things as if they're what? Normal. And our friends, you know, we just, rather than seeing them as our enemies. So knowing that, and labeling them as such, and treating them as such, is a step forward. But this ultimate, you know, how do you really scatter them, the way he says? How do you really drive them away? He says now they are scattered by the eye of wisdom. So where will you run now when driven from my mind? Whence would you return to do me harm? They cannot. Once they have been dispersed by our wisdom, and I'll talk about that in a minute, I'll read a verse of him. But oh, my mind is so feeble, I am so indolent. So, you know, this wisdom is available to us. This how to do it is available to us. But again, he talks about it, says, my mind is so feeble, I am so indolent. So again, I think this is very relatable. By all of us, whether we are practitioners of the Buddha Dharma, or whether we've just wandered in today, or practice some other spiritual tradition, to really be aware, what is us? What is it that makes us unhappy? What is it that robs us of our capacity for well-being? What is it that robs us of our open-heartedness, of our capacity to love, to be compassionate human beings? What is it? Well, it's stuff within our own mind, right? And if there is a person, if there was a person who is very deliberately going out of their way to harm us, we would call that person what? An enemy. I mean, that's what sort of an enemy means. An enemy is somebody who wants to harm us. And we often recognize in life an enemy. At work or other places, somebody who wants to do us harm. Somebody does who wants to somebody who wants to stop or prevent us from achieving our goals, right? We would call that person an enemy. And yet we do not have that same self-awareness about these enemies that dwell within, that are harming us, that are preventing us from achieving our goals and being the kind of person we want to be. So he's really kind of using verbiage that's often used in another realm, right? Political, social realm, or whatever, of enemies and foes. He's bringing it and making it very personal and saying we need to see, you know, that we do have enemies who want to harm us and rob us of our well-being, but they dwell within our minds. They are right here. And we are not taking action. We are feeble and indolent, and they can be scattered. There is a way. So before I get into the way, we have a little time. Are there any questions just about what's been said so far? Anything not make sense or unclear? If there's anything not clear or it doesn't make sense, please ask a question. This means everybody's with me? Just nod your head if that's true. I don't know. All right, so see, we need this first, you see? Something's got to rouse us to action, right? When our leaders want us to go to war, what do? They don't just one day tell you, oh, we're going to war tomorrow, right? What do for weeks or months leading up to the war? What? They prepare us by getting us nice and what? Pissed, agitated. There's an enemy, all right? So that's what he's doing here. Except it's not going after anybody else. It's not harming anybody. But that's sort of what I think he's doing. He's kind of rousing us up, saying, hey, guys, there's an enemy, and there's an enemy within, and he's trying to do you harm, and harming you all the time, and you just, you know, dwelling within your mind. And, you know, do you understand? You got an enemy inside you. You got a foe inside you that's always harming you, and right. And you got to be vigilant and diligent, and right. Okay, so that's what he's doing. Okay, so this is, 1,500 years before modern. The psychology of war. He already got it. Now, this is for, I think, many of you who are not familiar with Buddhist teaching, especially on emptiness. This next verse may seem a little difficult or foreign, but this is really kind of where Buddhism at a deeper level is coming. I mean, there are many in the Buddhist path, and those of you who practice know, there are many ways to work with one with afflictive emotions. We often talk about them here. There are many ways, but this is what he presents. So I'll go slowly. Okay. So let me just read it first. And we have kids today, right? The families are here, so. 25 minutes, we can do it. So, I'll read it first, and then we'll talk about it. Defilements, these are these emotional afflictions, defilements are not in the object, nor within the faculties, nor somewhere in between. And if not elsewhere, where is their abode? whence they inflict their havoc on the world. They are simply mirages. And so take heart. Banish all your fear and strive to know their nature. Why suffer needlessly the pains of suffering? Okay? So in this one paragraph is a ton of teaching. Okay? So let's just take, pick your favorite fear. Say, or your favorite anger, or your favorite jealousy, or pick your favorite emotional affliction. You may have many, but pick. Now he says, or let's take anger because anger is sort of simple. So you're angry at somebody, really angry. Anybody ever really been angry at somebody? Okay, we know about anger. All right. Now he says that anger, which he's calling defilement. The thing that's defiling our mind, he says, are not in the object, right? So if I was angry at Susan, right, that quality of anger, does it lie in Susan? No. I mean, if that quality of anger was in Susan, then everybody who looked at Susan would immediately get angry, right, if that anger was in her. Okay, so obviously the anger, doesn't dwell in her. And also, I may not always be angry at her. It took something to happen, for me to get angry at her. So again, we see that the anger does not dwell in the object. I mean, the object of my anger. Okay? So it doesn't dwell there. I can't blame her. I'd like to, but I can't, because when I look deeply into it, I see the anger that I'm feeling inside me is not in her, right? Or else it would be there all the time, and everybody who looked at her or thought about her would immediately get angry. Okay, so this is sort of logic. Okay. So he's saying, oh, okay, so it's not in the object, nor with it in the faculties. Now, if I'm angry at Susan, right, it's because I see her do something or I've heard her do something, right? I see her here, right? I mean, that's how we kind of connect to the world, right? Now, does the anger dwell in my eye? No, thank you. Does the anger dwell in my ear? No. My nose, my mouth, any of my senses? No, okay. So let me get straight. I'm really angry. It's really disturbing me. I'm obsessing. I'm ruminating. I can't even sleep at night. I'm so angry. But that anger doesn't dwell in Susan. It doesn't dwell in my eye or my ear or any of my faculties. I get it. It must dwell somewhere in between. So let me say, I'm over here. Susan over there. Could the anger be in here somewhere? Right? Right? Sort of somewhere in the ether there's this anger and somehow it's kind of taken us both in, and that's why I'm angry? I mean, this is logic, right? So what do you think? Could there be some anger just floating around in the air? No. Okay, just thank you. Okay. Or somewhere in between. So if this anger is not in Susan, it's not in my faculties that see and hear Susan, and is not in between, then where does my anger dwell? Whence they afflict their havoc on the world. So this is a very introspective question that meditation helps us see. So we would say, well, my anger must dwell where? In my mind. Well, let's look at that. Is my mind always angry? No. I mean, if something, something dwells somewhere permanently, then it would always be there, right? So, is my mind always angry? 24 hours, 27, even when I sleep, every dream is an angry dream. I wake up angry, every person I see I'm angry at, you know, then you'd say, oh yeah. But no. My mind perceives my anger, but it's not angry all the time. So I really can't say that anger is a permanent part of my mind, is it? Would you grant me that? It doesn't dwell within my mind all the time. We would say it's what? It's a temporary visitor, right? It's a temporary visitor. Why does it arise in my mind? Because of what? Causes and conditions. Okay, something has to happen. And that can happen even if Susan's not around, right? I can generate anger just by thinking about it or remembering it. So anger dwells in my mind. It only arises because of causes and conditions. I'm not angry at Susan all the time. I may be really angry at Susan. We may talk about it, work it out. She apologizes, or I listen to her, and I realize, you know, I really misinterpreted what happened, or just time goes on. All of a sudden, Susan does really something nice, and all of a sudden, wow, that Susan's a hell of a woman, right? Completely forget that I was so angry at her, right? I mean, okay, so. So this emotional affliction is not a solid, permanent thing that is always in our mind. Right? If it was, it would always be there. But it's not always there. Why does it arise? Because of causes and conditions. When those causes and conditions change, no more anger. So we would say that, so that is why he says, they are mirages. Mirages are something what? What's a mirage? Something that appears like they're there, but we know just causes and conditions, like a mirage in the desert or something, right? It's causes and conditions create the condition that we think we see water. But we say it's a mirage because there's really no water there. It's just causes and conditions have come together. We say a rainbow is a mirage, right? There's no such real thing as a mirage, but causes and conditions come together with light and moisture, and we all of a sudden see a rainbow. But it's a mirage. There's no substance to it. It's just causes and conditions have brought it together. So he says, in the same way, all our emotional afflictions have that same quality. They arise in the mind according to causes and conditions. But if looked at, see, this is the key piece, this is the meditative piece. But if looked at, one will see that there is nothing solid or substantial about them. They are only arising because of causes and conditions. Now again, when one sees a rainbow, one looks. But one knows what? It's a rainbow. We don't get in our car to go find it, to chase it, to possess it, do we? No, why not? I mean, it's something really incredible. Because we know what? It's not real. It appears, but it's not real. It has no substance. It has no solidity. It is just time limited according to causes and conditions. Now, it's a mirage. How do we know it's a mirage? Because we have wisdom. We understand the nature of our emotional afflictions. Why do we understand them? Because we've looked into them. Now, what is our problem? What is our laziness? What is our torpor? For most of us, when our anger, irritation, our anxieties, our fears, our sadnesses, our despair, our hurts arise in our mind, now we have to be honest here, what do we do? What? Yeah. They're the cause. So the anger in the object, right? They're the cause, right? Totally delusive. We just went through this. And yet when it happens, you know, there we go, right? The anger is in the object, right? What else do? Or not do? What? We retreat and we do what? No, we don't. We just don't retreat. But in our retreat, what do? What? Yeah, we ruminate. We just ruminate, right? So we keep feeding it. See, rumination, obsession, going over and over, imagining, replaying the scenario. When you're angry, how do you stay angry? Come on, we have a lot of professionals in here. You know, how do you stay angry? Think about it. Yeah, but how do we follow it? So what do we do? Think, what do we do? How do we feed it? What? We keep what? We keep repeating it over and over, thinking about it, replaying it. I can't believe, blaming, right? And it just gets what? Bigger, stronger, bigger, stronger. We have a little worry, what do? Blow it up. How do we do that? Because we think the fear is in the thing we're afraid of. It's going to happen. The fear is in us. There's nothing out there. There's just something that's happening or going to happen. That's all. Isn't that true? Where is fear and anxiety? In us. It's nowhere else. But we don't know that. We treat it as if it's real and solid. And we just, as Shanti Deva say, we indulge it. We are so patient. We said this is this misplaced patience. Patience is a virtue, but not, you know, we're patient with the wrong things. We're endlessly indulgent of the things that cause us misery. He's giving us an antidote. He's saying, stop. Look logically, intelligently, mindfully at what's going on and see the impermanent nature of this experience. See that the anger is only fear, is only arising in your own mind, that it has no substance. It wasn't there 5 minutes ago, and if you let it go, it won't be there 5 minutes from now. It is just a temporary arising because of causes and conditions. But because we mislabel, we see our enemies as our friends, we do what? When a friend, right? When somebody, when a scam or somebody calls you on the phone and you have caller ID and you see that number, what do? You don't pick it up, right? You don't pick it up. Why don't you pick it up? You don't want to talk to him. Everybody know what I'm talking about. You don't want to talk to him. When you look down at the number and it's your friend, you do what? You pick it up. There's discernment. You know friend from foe. Is that clear? You know friend from foe. Very simple discernment. But with our own emotions, we do not have that discernment, right? When our anger, when our fear, when our despair comes calling, what do? Hi. Yeah, let's talk about this. And we're available for as long as they want, right? I mean, we'll talk about it for days, right? You know, it's like we keep the line open, we'll fall asleep at night, and the first thing we wake up in the morning, we'll just pick the phone up, continue. Right? We might even wake up in the middle of the night and just continue the conversation. It's such a good one. Do you see how crazy it is? But it's not just crazy. It's the source of misery for us. And not only is it that, which you'd think would be enough, right? You'd think that would be enough to wake us up. But what else? We also have spiritual aspiration. Transformation. Yeah, I want to be somebody who has a wholesome mind. Yeah, I don't want to have anger and fear and closed-heartedness, right? Isn't that true? So this is also doing harm to that. So this is, again, this is very short, and this is a deep teaching, but this is, again, and there are many teachings in Buddhism about how to work with afflictive emotions, but this is the most direct way to see the empty nature of the whole process. There's nothing there, there's really nothing here, there's nothing in between. Just let it be. And generate what you want to generate. Right? If you think someone has acted unskillfully, what should you do? What? Talk to them. Let them know what's going on with you. How about that? Instead of cultivating anger and hurt and resentment for days and hours, talk to them. Okay. How about, looking into their causes and conditions, maybe their suffering. Right? So you never thought of that one. Maybe I need to generate a little more understanding toward them. Maybe I ought to open my heart to them. Right? See, we never thought of that one. We expect them to do that for us. But the idea that, how do we want to be treated by others? Anybody here want to be treated by understanding? Would they like the people around them to be understanding of them? Of course. If somehow we're having a bad day and a little irritated or whatever, would we like somebody to kind of know what we're going through and kind of work with us and give us the message, you're having a difficult day, you must be suffering, I can tell you're getting a little bent out of shape about little things. Would you want to talk about it? How can I be of help to you? Anybody would like anybody to treat them that way when they're having a rough day? Of course we would. And yet, do we offer that to others? Do we offer that to others? So, there are many ways. But the key point is to see that these afflictive emotions that dwell within our mind are 100% our own responsibility. We cannot put it on anybody else. Because the anger, the hurt, is not in them, it's in us. The fear is in us. Things are just happening in the world. People are just being who they are, doing what they do. Isn't that true? And the emotional response is coming from within us. And that's good. Because that means if I don't want to be a negative person, if I don't want to be someone who's afflicted with afflictive emotions, I can do it. And as Shanti Deva, I love this chapter because first he goes, they're the enemies. Ooh, these enemies that well within, they'll do us so much harm. And at the end he goes, but I just want to let you know, it's all a mirage. They're really not so substantial. Just kind of see clearly. These are not like external enemies who have the power to do you harm. These they don't have the power to do you harm, because, but it's just that we let them do us harm because we see them as solid, real things. Now, is everybody going to walk out of here with this kind of wisdom and ability today? No. Unfortunately, we got to do the work. What's the work? Mindfulness, meditation, concentration, insight. You know, we have to develop the ability, first of all, to have some space within our mind, some mindfulness, some awareness, so we can see what's going on. Right? We need to create some space so we're not so reactive. Right? Because even though we may have this intelligence from reading, if we don't have the space in our life or the meditative stability to kind of see what's going on and just to be reactive, it's not going to work either, is it? So this is why, you know, we have to do these practices so we can implement this very simple program here. It's very simple, isn't it? I mean, everybody intellectually not get it. We all get it. We all understand it. It seems so right. Well, why can't we implement it? Well, because we don't have the ground and the stability and the knowledge yet. But if you walk this path, you will get it because it's in you already. But you have to develop skill like anything else. So again, this is a path, and we take one piece like this, but we realize there are other pieces that aren't being spoken about, but that are just known. So any questions? We have 4 minutes, or maybe, I'm not sure what time the kids are coming. Are there any questions about what has been shared today? Both the earlier practice of how to view afflictive emotions and this practice of seeing their empty nature. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it doesn't mean that. Yeah. So again, it is there are different ways of doing it. Obviously, see, the problem is these word. Yeah. So the question is about just defining the word empty. Does that really describe it? The word in Sanskrit is shunyata. And like many words in Sanskrit, these are words that have multiple meanings in one word. Right. And so the problem with the translator has is they're taking this big idea that has many shades of meaning and having to translate and come up with one word. So for whatever reason, people have come up with the word emptiness. But yeah, the problem with most of us, we say, oh, look, like, you know, the air is empty, right? But emptiness doesn't mean that at all. Empty means it's empty of any solidity. It's empty of any permanence. It's empty of any permanent, solid self, right? So we would say, like, let's take an emotion like anger, right? When we're in it, it feels very what? Solid. And we talk about it as something like anger, like it's a thing. But is there any thing, solid thing, called anger? No. Right? No. We talk about thoughts like thoughts are solid things. Are thoughts solid things? No. Please look into your mind right now and tell me what a thought looks like. I mean, everybody, there's 70, 80 people here. Please look in your mind right now. What does a thought look like? Can you see a thought? Can you see a thought? I mean, how big is it? Does it have a shape? I mean, yeah. We talk about thoughts. They have an appearance, but there's nothing, there's no solid, real thing. It's empty of solidity. That's what it means. It's empty of. So that's shunyata, this empty nature of things. It doesn't mean that things don't appear, right? So we would say this flower is empty of any solid flower. What does that mean? It sounds crazy. It means that this is really just many, many parts. Many, 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 many parts. Right? That have come together temporarily and manifesting like this, and we give it a name. What do we call it? Flower or orchid. But is there any solid, permanent orchid that will be here forever? If we take it apart, we take all the petals off, and if we cut up the stem, and if we cut up the leaves, and we put it all out, are you going to find anything called a flower? No. And yet we call it a flower. No, that's okay, because, you know, if you say, could somebody please bring me the flower, you don't want them to bring you the salt or something. You want them to bring you this. So it's convenient. Convenient to say, I have anger in me. But when you look into your mind, you're not going to find anything called anger, are you? Has anybody looked in their mind and found a solid thing called anger? It's like so big. Solid anger thing. Has anybody found one? Try fear. Anybody here ever have anxiety or fear? When you look into your mind for something called anxiety or fear, do you find anything? No. You find sensations in your body, and you find thoughts that arise and pass away in your mind. That's all you find. You don't find anything called anxiety or fear. There's nothing solid. They just come and go. They arise and disappear. Why do they arise and disappear? Because they're not solid, permanent things. If this flower were the solid, permanent thing, it would always be here. It couldn't change. If we were a solid, permanent thing, we couldn't change. So there'd be no reason to come here today. You know? Right, Brendan, you'd be Brendan. If you were a solid, permanent thing, the way you are now, you would be that way forever, wouldn't you? Yeah. But you're not that way. Why? Why are you able to change? Because you're empty. Because you're empty. You're empty of any solidity. So therefore, you can transform the parts. That's why the teachings on emptiness are so positive. So we were once like this, but we've changed. If it wasn't for emptiness, we would be like this forever. So we'll end here.